Good day. Today is Saturday, 25th April 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you watch this programme, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, before I turn to the main topic of this programme, which is certain events that have been taking place in Moscow and the latest developments in the conflict involving Ukraine, I would like to discuss briefly the visit to Islamabad of the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. Now, the reports that Araghchi was travelling to Islamabad began to circulate late on Wednesday and continued on Thursday, and there was much speculation as to what were the exact reasons why he was going, and there was much speculation that he was intending to meet with the Americans in Islamabad and that he would continue the talks that took place about two weeks ago now, between Iran and the United States, between the Iranian delegations headed by Araghchi and Ghalibaf, the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, and the United States delegation headed by J.D. Vance. And as we know, there was another attempt about a week ago to get these talks started again. There was talk that there would be a further meeting between the Iranians and the Americans in Islamabad on Monday. There was dithering in Washington as to who would lead the American delegation, whether it would be led by the Vice President, J.D. Vance, who was the chief negotiator at the previous meeting with the Iranians, or whether it would be the duo of Witkoff and Kushner, which has disastrously, in my opinion, mismanaged all the previous talks between the United States and Iran. But in the event the Iranians didn't send a delegation to Islamabad, and in the absence of an American delegation, the Americans decided that there was no point in them going either. Well, there was a lot of rumour, lots of discussion about what the purpose of Araghchi's visit to Islamabad, what that was all about. There was suggestions that he was going to Islamabad to restart the meetings with the Americans. There were reports that Ghalibaf, who was actually the lead negotiator in the previous meeting, that Ghalibaf had stood down and that he was no longer the delegation leader, the chief negotiator anymore. And the President of the United States seems to have got very excited about this visit by Araghchi to Islamabad. And sure enough, he has ordered the duo of Witkoff and Kushner to fly to Islamabad, apparently in the hope that they might be able to catch up with and meet Araghchi whilst he is there. A further sign, by the way, that behind all the bluster, all the threats and all of the extraordinary rhetoric that we have been seeing over the last couple of days, the president is not keen on a resumption of the war, the kinetic part of the war, that he wants a settlement as quickly as possible, that he wants to come to an agreement as fast as he can with the Iranians so that the Strait of Hormuz can be reopened and everything can return to normal, except, of course, that the president still wants an agreement very much on his terms, which, as I've discussed in many programmes, are obviously unacceptable to the Iranians. Anyway, this unedifying spectacle of the Americans racing to Islamabad to catch up with Araqchi has now turned to dust, because exactly as I anticipated, the Iranians have said that Araqchi has no plan to meet with the Americans whilst he is in Islamabad. This is a round trip by Araqchi. Araqchi, in other words, doing his job for the first time since the start of the conflict on the 28th of February. Araqchi is doing what we might call conventional diplomacy. He's visiting the countries that are critical to Iran in this conflict, countries which are friendly to Iran and which certainly do have a role in the war. But his visit to Islamabad was because he wanted to meet with the Pakistanis. He's going to the Omani capital, Muscat, to meet with the Omanis afterwards, and apparently the other capital that he intends to visit is Moscow, further confirming my repeated point that it is the Russians who are the major great power supporter of Iran in this conflict. So he's not going to meet with the Americans, and Witkoff and Kushner, if they do indeed fly to Islamabad, are going there for nothing. Frankly, given how the Iranians feel about Kushner and Witkoff, I think it was an extraordinary mistake for the president again to send them to Islamabad for a meeting with the Iranians. I cannot imagine two people that the Iranians are less keen to meet than those two at this time. And anyway, sending them to Islamabad to meet with the Iranians further reinforces the Iranian conviction that for the moment, there is no reason for talks with the Americans at all. The Americans are not really ready for talks at the present time. There needs to be more time given to the blockade and the counter-blockade and the growing problems of oil and energy shortage. That is Iran's ace in the pack for the moment. The Iranians want to see that play out fully, and until that time, they're not really willing to meet the Americans, especially after the failure of the previous round of talks in Islamabad 2 weeks ago. So that's the situation at the moment. Now, it is intriguing, it is very interesting that Araqchi is flying to Moscow. The reports say that he's going to Moscow. He does not, interestingly, appear to be going to Beijing. And I'm going to guess that despite all of the favourable words, the words of friendship between Iran and China, there are some tensions. The Iranians, when the fighting began on the 28th of February, made it very clear that they did not want a ceasefire of any kind until the Americans agreed to negotiate on their terms. The ceasefire that we see in effect at the moment is one which the Iranians had originally resisted agreeing to. The Iranians only agreed to the ceasefire because of Chinese pressure, and that pressure only became fully effective when the Russians made clear, as they did through a statement published by their foreign ministry, that Russia was supporting the mediation efforts in this conflict being carried out by China and Pakistan. So the Iranians are in a ceasefire that they had not originally sought and had said that they would not agree to, and which they agreed to against their better judgment under Chinese pressure. And, well, they're now going to Moscow, and I suspect that they want to discuss with the Russians the future diplomacy. They want to impress on the Russians that they're not happy about the way in which they were pushed into the current ceasefire. They're not convinced that that plays to their advantage in this conflict. They will want Russia's support in future to withstand any further pressure to make more concessions from the Pakistanis and from the Chinese. And the Iranians also, obviously, will want promises from the Russians of further economic and military assistance as the standoff with the United States continues. It is very likely that when Araghchi arrives in Moscow, he will have a meeting not just with the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, but that he will also be meeting with other senior Russian officials, perhaps Defense Minister Belousov, perhaps Sergei Shoigu, the Secretary of the Security Council, but first and foremost with Vladimir Putin, the President of Russia himself. So this is an important diplomatic trip, and the attempt of the Americans to gatecrash in on it is not, I suspect, at all welcome at this time in Tehran. Just saying. Now, in every other respect, the conflict between the United States and Iran remains in impasse. There is really nothing further to say as compared to what I said over the previous days. The Iranian government remains in full control of the country. Expectations that some people have that in 2 or 3 weeks' time, Iran's economy is going to collapse are, in my opinion, completely misconceived. I spoke about an opinion poll made by Iranian agencies within Iran about the solid support that the Iranian government appears to have within Iran itself. That opinion poll has now been supplemented by an entirely different opinion poll carried out by a Western polling agency, which is discussed in Responsible Statecraft, the website of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And this opinion poll, which focuses more on what you might call the pro-Western element within Iran, its conclusion is that the size of that pro-Western element has always been overstated. We are talking about a relatively small section of Iranian society, fluctuating between about 10 and 25%, depending on political conditions. It makes the point that since the start of the conflict, that pro-Western element in Iran has shrunk significantly in size. And it makes the further point that pro-Western in this context has to be treated very carefully. It's true that the people who make up this group tend to be people who would prefer better relations with the West, would want to adopt a more secular style of life in Iran itself. But they are revealed in this opinion poll to be deeply patriotic and nationalistic, and to support Iran's, a majority of them support Iran's retention of its ballistic missile arsenal and its uranium enrichment program, there simply isn't a level of support inside Iran that would put sustained pressure on the Iranian authorities to compromise, or which would seek the collapse of the entire political system in Iran. Such people exist, but they are relatively few, and in political terms at this time, they are inconsequential. So expectations that in 2 or 3 weeks' time, under economic pressures, because Iran can't export oil, which of course, as we know, it is exporting because the sea blockade isn't working. Expectations that the entire political system in Iran is going to collapse or come under extraordinary pressure, that there will be a breakdown in will, and that the Iranians will capitulate, or that the present government will split, and that there will be negotiations between the Iranians and the Americans by a more moderate faction with Iran. All of that at the moment seems to be groundless speculation, which has no basis of fact or reality behind it. The Iranian government remains in control. The Strait of Hormuz remains under Iranian control. The Iranians have a massive stockpile, apparently, of sea mines that they can plant in the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf, and which perhaps they are planting. Their military overall remains in being and functional and loyal to the government. The IRGC remains loyal to the government. There is no sign of these internal fractures in Iran. And in all respects, therefore, the stalemate, the test of will between Iran and the United States continues. And yes, the Iranians are under a certain amount of pressure, but it is the Americans ultimately who perhaps are under the greater pressure, because it is in the West that there is less tolerance to the economic difficulties that people are going to face as energy costs and inflation rises. So that is the reality of the conflict at the moment. There continues to be speculation that Donald Trump, the President of the United States, at some point may return to war. It is certainly possible. It is a possibility that cannot be discounted or ignored at all. But at the moment, we are in stalemate. We are in a situation, or rather more properly, in impasse. We are in an economic war of attrition, one which works to Iran's advantage, and one where the Iranians feel that they need to shore up support amongst their friends, given the long duration of this war of economic attrition, which is what explains the foreign tour of the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi and his trip to the capital of the country, which is most critical to Iran at the moment, to the capital of Russia, to Moscow, and his meeting with the Russian leadership. And I am going to suggest that those things which I talked about yesterday, the statements by a senior Russian general about the shining example that Iran's military have provided of resistance to aggression, the decision by the Iranians to allow toll-free access for ships connected to Russia passing through the Strait of Hormuz, all of these now make sense. They are clearly overtures that the Russians and the Iranians are making to each other ahead of these important talks, important for the Iranians, these important talks that are going to take place when Araghchi arrives in Moscow. It is incredible, it is astonishing that apart from one telephone call between the President of the United States, Donald Trump, and Vladimir Putin early on in this conflict, a telephone call which went extremely badly, by the way, it is incredible that no US official has so far thought of speaking to the Russians about this war, given the key role the Russians are playing as the supporters and backers of Iran. At some point, logically, a senior American diplomat, best of all the vice president or the secretary of state, should be visiting Moscow to have serious discussions with the Russians about the war. But that has not happened. And, well, the vice president is, as we all know, in political difficulties. And as for the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, well, as I've already said in other programs, I am not sure exactly what he does anymore. He claims to be, he occupies the office of America's chief diplomat, but he doesn't travel to China, he doesn't travel to Russia, he doesn't do much diplomacy at all. He's barely been to the Middle East since this crisis began. He basically sits in Washington, stays in Washington, agrees apparently with what the president says, and then leaks stories to the media saying the opposite, and attends matches, sports matches with the president, rather than doing what I would have thought was his job. But anyway, look, I am not going to discuss this further. I've said what I wanted to say. I now want to turn to a far more interesting and indeed extraordinary statement made in Moscow by that extremely busy and very active diplomat, who is, of course, Sergei Lavrov, who is the foreign minister of Russia. And it is worth pointing out that Lavrov, unlike Rubio, is indeed an exceptionally busy man. He has recently been in Beijing, where he met with Wang Yi and Xi Jinping. He then went to Antalya, where he attended an important conference. And yesterday, in the afternoon, in Moscow, he attended a meeting of Russian non-profit organizations. And he gave there one of the most astonishing speeches that he has made in his long career as Russia's foreign minister. And, well, I'm now going to read the sections of it that stand out for me in full. He says that the situation in the world is very critical, and he puts the blame squarely on the West. The West's decades-long expansion into the Eurasian continent, primarily the regions where Russia has historically had strong influence and legitimate traditional interests, is a major factor of global destabilization. The persistent push, which in recent years has openly manifested itself in the slogan of inflicting a strategic defeat on Russia, reflects a long-standing, centuries-long strategy. And then he continues that a war against us has been openly declared. Those are his words. A war against us has been openly declared. The Kiev regime is being used as the tip of the spear. Everyone is aware that this tip is unusable without Western supplies of weapons, intelligence data, satellite systems, training of military personnel, and much more. The Kiev regime and the Ukrainian state are being openly taken advantage of as a geopolitical battering ram. Some rather outspoken individuals, I believe in the Belgian general staff, have publicly stated that they're getting ready for war with Russia and that Ukraine is helping them buy time. They could not be clearer. In order to justify their policy, the West, above all the international bureaucracy in Brussels, both the EU and NATO, are increasingly becoming one, as well as Berlin, Paris, and of course London, are attempting to demonize everything Russian and openly speak about gearing up for war with us in the foreseeable future. And then there's a great deal more, and he discusses how all of this comes together with the extraordinary policies that are being conducted by the Western powers in the Middle East, about which, by the way, he is similarly scathing. He gives a kind of half nod to the Americans. He says that they at least rhetorically do appear to recognize that Russia does have certain legitimate security interests. But he goes on to say that the Europeans have been working continuously and incessantly and so far successfully to keep the war between Ukraine and Russia going. And he says that though the Americans have expressed some support for the entire Donbass region, Donetsk and Lugansk regions being recognized as part of Russia, as stipulated in the Russian constitution, and even though nobody is seriously disputing the status of Crimea anymore, Zelensky furiously rejects this, and he has the Europeans backing him. And he goes on to say that the Europeans are not merely backing him, but they're backing him with promises of sending some kind of European force to Ukraine to support the Ukrainians and, in effect, to preserve what Lavrov speaks of as the regime there. Well, some of this are things that Lavrov has said in the past, but I have never seen him or heard him say or heard him use words like a war against us has been openly declared. In effect, he's saying that Russia and certainly Europe are now in conflict. They are in effect at war with each other. The war has not yet escalated into outright fighting, but the probability, the possibility of that remains very real. And in the meantime, the Europeans are happy to sacrifice Ukraine as part of that war, which they are currently prosecuting against the Russians. As Larry Johnson, that most insightful of commentators, has correctly pointed out on his blog, Sonar 21, the Russian Foreign Ministry is now increasingly turning from talking about diplomacy to talking about Russia's need to mobilize, to prepare itself for a future conflict, if not with the entire West, at least with Europe. And, well, the Russian Foreign Ministry has now published further comments. They've talked about certain comments made by the French ambassador to Russia, Nicolas de Rivière. Nicolas de Rivière has talked about how proposals made by the Coalition of the Willing might be the basis of his future settlement of the Ukrainian conflict. The Russian Foreign Ministry has responded by saying that de Rivière's ideas are nonsensical. This is how TASS, the official Russian news agency, discusses the Russian Foreign Ministry's words. They say that de Rivière's comments are detached from reality. They provide a highly distorted view of the Ukrainian crisis. His ideas about the possibility of resolving the Ukrainian conflict based on the French-initiated Coalition of the Willing proposals are designed purely to uphold the interests of the bankrupt Kiev regime and its sponsors from Europe's war party, that the proposals are highly fanciful. Neither France nor other EU countries are currently participants in any negotiation process. All actions by Paris and other Europeans are aimed at derailing any positive process on the progress on the European crisis. On the part of France, we do not see constructive proposals aimed at finding mutually acceptable solutions, but rather attempts to launch parallel initiatives, the result of which could be imposed on Russia in a definitive manner. Such an undiplomatic approach, completely detached from the actual situation on the ground, is doomed to failure from the start. And Nicolas de Rivière knows firsthand about France's participation in the Normandy process, the role of the previous French president, François Hollande, which merely served as a smokescreen for allowing the Kiev regime more time and portraying Ukraine as some sort of victim for aggression is simply an attempt to absolve responsibility for the collapse of the Minsk agreements and to justify France's destructive role in the acute conflict that has erupted in Ukraine. So we see the rhetoric from the Russians about the Europeans get harsher and harsher. And this cannot be detached from the recent statements by Medvedev, by Lavrov himself, by Shoigu, the warnings to the Baltic states about allowing their airspace to be used for attacks on Russian territory, the warnings about the discrimination against Russian speakers in the Baltic states and potentially, by the way, in other countries. The Russians have recently started talking about Moldova in this context as well. The warning from the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Ulyanov about the Baltic states being unwise to think that the Russians are scared of taking action against the Baltic states, if they must do. And of course, the new law passed by the Duma, authorizing Putin to deploy the Russian military abroad in order to protect Russian speakers without first having to consult the Russian parliament. So the rhetoric from Moscow is getting harsher and harsher. And here we have Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, somebody who's recently been in Beijing having discussions and consultations with the Chinese leadership. Here we see Lavrov coming forward and saying that Russia and Europe are now in effect in a state of war with each other, that the Europeans have effectively already declared war on Russia. And I spoke about Lavrov's recent visit to China, but in Moscow, the Russian Defense Minister, Andrei Belousov, has also just received a strong military delegation from the Chinese Defense Ministry, which is traveling to Russia. We see that contacts between the Chinese and Russian governments appear currently to be being stepped up. And of course, we have rumours of an imminent trip by Putin to China, perhaps in the middle of May. So all of this is going on. Now, something else happened in Moscow yesterday, which I am not sure how to explain. Yesterday, there was a meeting of Russia's Security Council, the top policy-making body in Russia. Now, there is absolutely nothing unusual about this. The Security Council carries out regular meetings. And we are told that the meeting took place in the Kremlin. And there is indeed a picture of Vladimir Putin at a long table in the Kremlin where he is conducting the meeting. However, what is interesting about this meeting is that Putin was the only person who physically attended the meeting itself, who was physically present in the Kremlin. All of the other members of the Security Council, and according to the list provided by the Kremlin, all of them participated in the meeting. Mishustin, Medvedev, Shoigu, Patrushev, Belousov, Lavrov, all of them, they're all there. Everybody who is a permanent member that I'm aware of was present. Anyway, despite the fact that they all participated in the meeting, none, not one of them, apart from Putin himself, seems to have come to the Kremlin to be physically present. Now, I do find that rather strange. All of the other people who were involved in this meeting participated virtually. And if you see the picture, the photograph of the meeting provided by the Kremlin, you have Putin sitting at the usual long table, and there is in front of him an enormous screen, and you see all of the pictures of the various participants, of all of the people that I've been talking about. You see them there attending virtually this meeting. But I would assume that all of them are in Moscow. One would imagine that they would come to attend in person a meeting of the Security Council with the President of Russia. And, well, I don't have any explanation for this. There is, however, something else about this meeting, which I admit I also found rather strange. And that is that though the meeting, we are told, was to discuss measures to prevent and combat offences and crime, one person who attended the meeting was not, and who is not a member of the Security Council, as well as the Prosecutor General, Alexander Goodson, but one other person who attended the meeting was the Deputy Minister of Defence and head of the main military political directorate of the Armed Forces of Russia, Viktor Goremykin. Now, Goremykin is not a member of the Security Council. And, well, why was he there? The main military political directorate is the department of the Russian military that provides ideological guidance and instruction to the servicemen, the soldiers within the military. It's the organization that informs the soldiers about what the war is about and what the fighting is about, and which takes charge of what you might call political education of the army. It's a carryover from an earlier structure that existed in the Soviet era, which was re-established by the Russians back in 2018. So he is an important military official. Goremykin is an important military official, heading in an organization which provides an important military political function. But why was he there? Why was he participating in the meeting? It's not obvious, for example, that he would be there to discuss crime and some role involving criminal offences. Well, he might be there to discuss war crimes. But what was he doing in this meeting? And why did no one else, none of the other people who belong to the Security Council, bother to take the trip to the Kremlin and turn up? Just saying. Now, it could be that this is a completely unimportant meeting dealing with routine questions. These are all very busy people. They prefer to conduct the meeting from their office. Goremykin was there because in a discussion about criminal offences and that kind of thing, well, some of these offences do take place within the military, and it was considered useful to have him there. It might also be that independently of that business of the meeting, crime and public order offences and that sort of thing, Goremykin anyway had a report to provide about the work of the directorate that he serves. So it may be that this was a routine meeting, very unimportant. Nobody therefore felt the need to turn up, and it was agreed that it be discussed virtually. That is possible. But might there be some other reason connected instead with all of these other issues that I have been talking about? The steady, relentless escalation of the rhetoric about Europe, about the conflict in Ukraine, about the Baltic states, the warnings given to the Baltic states, the build-up of the Russian military that continues to take place. Might it be all related to that? Might it be also the case that Goremykin attended this meeting because there was some kind of a discussion about the kind of guidance that the Security Council and Putin needed to give him about the kind of instructions that the soldiers, the officers and soldiers of the Russian army needed to be provided in this, shall we say, shadow war situation that we are seeing between the Russians and the Europeans at this particular point in time. That still wouldn't explain why nobody apart from Putin himself physically turned up. Just saying, there might have been. However, you can imagine all kinds of security issues. I am not going to speculate about what those might have been. Again, it may be that I'm reading too much into this. Maybe, as I said, this was indeed an unimportant routine meeting, and that was the reason why nobody went. But I think in this rather fraught time, with all the other things that we are seeing take place, it's perhaps as well to ask the question. Anyway, there we are. That is the situation at the present time in the Kremlin. Putin, by the way, he still gives every sign of being fully in control. Lavrov, over the course of that speech that I've just quoted from, was careful to, well, refer to him several times, clearly identifying him, Putin, as the person who is in overall charge. So to repeat again a point that Gordon Hahn and I discussed on a recent program we did on the Duran, there is no sign here, no hint of any kind of political crisis in Russia at the present time. But we do have this intensifying rhetoric, this very, very strong rhetoric from the Russians. And of course, it is backed by military moves. Now, when I talk about military moves, here I'm going to discuss the military situation. I've already said in a number of programs that we are now well within the early period of the Russian spring and summer offensive, and it appears to be making fairly rapid progress given the relatively early period of that offensive in which we now find ourselves. Over the course of last night, as it happens, the Russians conducted one of their biggest, most powerful missile and drone strikes across Ukraine that we have seen for some time. According to the Ukrainians, 666 drones and missiles were launched at Ukraine over the course of last night. The city of Dnipro on the Dnieper River appears to have been a particularly heavy target, which makes complete sense because it is one of the key logistical bases supporting Ukrainian military operations in Donbass. So this operation got well underway last night. The Ukrainians again have made their usual inflated claims about the number of Russian drones and missiles that they successfully shot down. Again, it bewilders me that after the failure of Western ballistic missile defenses, and by the way, of Ukrainian drone operators and technology in the Persian Gulf, that people continue to take these Ukrainian claims of shooting down the bulk of the drones and the bulk of the missiles seriously. In fact, video footage has apparently appeared, I haven't seen it, but video footage has apparently appeared of Russian drones flying above the districts of Odessa and the surrounding countryside. Odessa was another major target of the missile and drone strike. Anyway, footage has appeared showing the drones and the missiles flying over Odessa without much or indeed any sign of significant damage or of the Ukrainians successfully intercepting anything. I don't get any impression of any serious damage being done to of any significant shootdowns of missiles and drones happening over the city of Dnipro either. So anyway, people still report these Ukrainian claims in the West as if they are true. I've never taken them very seriously myself. But, well, people, I suppose, still want to cling to those illusions. But the drone and missile strike, big as it was, and from what I can tell, focusing heavily now on logistics, the Russians in particular have been busy hunting and destroying Ukraine's limited stockpile of diesel locomotives, with electric power increasingly subject to cut off. The Ukrainians have been increasingly dependent on diesel locomotives to move their trains, their supply trains, which are what they principally use to keep their forces functioning and supplied in Donbass. But in any event, this was a big strike, a very big and very powerful strike. I will no doubt return to it in a future programme when there is a better idea of what exactly the Russians were attacking and what level of damage was actually done. But alongside this big drone and missile strike that the Russians carried out last night, there have been further reports about developments of the military situation in the conflict area, the situation on the actual front lines. And it is to this now that I will briefly turn. Firstly, if we go to what is perhaps the single most important piece of news over the last 24 hours, there are now reports that the Russians have completed the capture of the important, heavily fortified town of Belitskaya, north of Pokrovsk and Rodinska. Now, Belitska is one of these towns built during the period of the Soviet Union with high-rise buildings and big factories. And it has been a natural fortress which has been fought over for a while and which the Russians have been trying to capture over the last few weeks. Its capture would bring the Russians much closer to the important town of Dobropilia, which is the most important town still under Ukrainian control in western Donbass. In fact, if Dobropilia is captured by the Russians, basically that is the end of Ukrainian resistance in northwestern Donbass. Just saying. But anyway, there has been this battle that has been going on for Belitskaya. And Belitskaya is also important in that its capture clears the way for the Russians to conduct an envelopment operation surrounding the towns of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk from the west, if that is indeed ultimately the plan, if it is indeed the plan for the Russians to create a gigantic cauldron of the Ukrainian forces that are still holding out in these two important cities, the two last important remaining cities in Donbass. Then the Russians need to control Belitsko. To do it, and the capture of Belitsko puts the moment when that happens, brings that moment much closer. It would also, by the way, be a further sign following the fall of Gnishino, somewhat to the south and west, that in this critically important area, you could argue in some respects, the most important defensive area of all for the Ukrainians in Donbass, that the Russians are not just advancing, but are advancing fairly rapidly and effectively. But anyway, the news, the confirmation of the capture of Belitsko, for the moment, is still coming from Russian reporting channels. It has not been confirmed by the Russian Defense Ministry. So perhaps we should wait a few days to see whether this is really so. But there have been many reports now that Belitsko is indeed about to fall. So most likely these reports are probably true. Now, there's a lot going on elsewhere as well. I discussed recently the build up by the Russians of a 5-division paratroop force in western Zaporozhye region, immediately to the south of the city of Zaporozhye. There's apparently been intense fighting going on in eastern Zaporozhye. Eastern here is perhaps somewhat wrong, in the sense that we're not really looking at the east of Zaporozhye region anymore. The Russians arguably control eastern Zaporozhye region, certainly since the capture of Guliapolye, the city of Guliapolye, at the end of last year. Rather, it is fighting that is taking place in central, north-central Zaporozhye region, immediately to the east of the key town of Orekhov. And, well, there are now reports that the Russians are very close to completing the capture of two villages, Guliapolske and Verkhnya Tersa, which are located to the northeast of Orekhov. If these two towns are captured, then we are indeed very close to the moment of the complete encirclement of Orekhov. And, well, we will see whether in that case the Ukrainians decide to defend Orekhov or do what is perhaps the wiser thing to do, which is to pull their forces from Orekhov to withdraw to the city of Zaporozhye and to make their defence there. My guess, given that we're talking about Zelensky and Syrsky, is that instead of doing that, they will insist on the defence of Orekhov, dooming the Ukrainian garrison to its fate. The battle of Orekhov is probably only a few weeks away now. The Russians already control positions immediately to the south of Orekhov in villages like Novodanilovka and Malaya Tokmachka. If the Russians break through in the northeast, well, the days of Orekhov are indeed at that point counted. It will be a collapse rather similar to the one we saw a few months ago in the town of Siversk in northern Donbass. So anyway, these events are playing out rapidly. There's been many reports of other Russian advances. There's been reports that the Russians are now, as I discussed, in the process of storming a village called Raigorodok, which lies to the west of Liman, and which is very close to Slavyansk, and which, by the way, lies between Liman and Slavyansk. Gerasimov, the Russian commander, recently said that the Russians now control around 70% of Liman. So anyway, we shall see. The Russians, by the way, have never up to now controlled Raigorodok at any point in the war. There was a lot of speculation after the first fall of Liman in May 2022 that the Russians would capture Raigorodok, but they never did. If it does indeed fall, and if another town in this general area, the town of Svyatogorsk, also falls, well, we are indeed in that case looking at the first days of the battle for Slavyansk. Raigorodok, in particular, is widely seen as a suburb of Slavyansk. And I noticed that the Ukrainians yesterday admitted that Russian troops have entered the important village of Rai Alexandrovka, located on a hill to the east of Kramatorsk. Apparently, there are now Russian troops at the centre of this village. They broke into it from the south, and Russian troops have also entered this village from the east. It is a large village. It is on a hill. It is strategically important. Probably the battle for it still has some way to go, but it is clearly a battle which is now joined, which is no doubt being heavily fought, and well, the outcome, at least there, is not in doubt. So Belitska perhaps has fallen, Rai Alexandrovka falling too, Raigorodok perhaps also under pressure, Liman under pressure. You can see the cauldron around Slavyansk and Kramatorsk in its early stages of taking shape and of a deepening crisis in Orekhov as well. And, well, no talk from the Russians of negotiations. There was some speculation a couple of days ago that the duo of Witkoff and Kushner would be coming to Moscow again. There were rumours that they would be visiting Kiev as well. There was, as I remember, some actual alarm expressed in Kiev about their pending visit and whether Witkoff and Kushner would be coming with more demands for the Ukrainians to give up Donbass. But in the event they didn't show, that there was no show, Witkoff and Kushner didn't visit Kiev. They're not expected in Moscow. The Russians don't seem to be very interested in negotiations at the present time. Instead, as we saw with Lavrov, the Russians now are talking about war, not just war in Ukraine, but about a bigger war, a war between themselves and Europe. Now, all of this is happening without any awareness or discussion in Europe about it at all. It's not that the Europeans don't talk about a threat from the Russians. They talk about this incessantly. This is the justification for the rearmament drive in Germany. It is the justification for the talk about rearmament in Britain, which is an idiotic idea, given the extent of the financial and political crisis in Britain at the moment, just saying. The Europeans talk about this incessantly. They talk about it continuously. They talk about the need to build up their weapons in the absence of the Americans. We've seen discussions about nuclear weapons in Finland, about attacks on St. Petersburg, about attacks in Kaliningrad. We've not actually seen any real deployment, redeployment of forces, or any actual military production appearing so far. I was reading a long article in the Daily Telegraph about German rearmament and about how well Germany is doing in terms of rearmament. But when you drill into the article carefully, the thing that immediately notice, or at least I immediately notice, is that it's all about how much money Germany is spending about rearmament. It's not about any actual additional tanks, armoured vehicles, fighter jets, missiles, rockets, or even drones that this rearmament has actually been producing. In fact, as I've said already in a number of places, in my opinion, all of this talk of rearmament, especially in Germany, is mostly a means for the German government to provide, at a time of extreme budgetary stress, a further financial subsidy to the struggling German car industry. So Volkswagen, which is under considerable pressure and which has been talking about closing factories in Germany, now is receiving money from the German government to keep them open and to keep the workers at these factories still on the books. And it is all being justified on the basis that these factories will, at some unknown, indeterminate date in the future, in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, if it's going to be done at all, it will take at least 10 years. At some point in the last 10 years, these factories are going to be converted to military production. That's my own view about what all of this brave talk in Europe about rearmament is really all about. As we have seen, projects to build fighter jets in Europe, to develop a new European fighter jet, a fifth generation fighter jet. This is after the Americans, the Russians and the Chinese have already been building fifth generation jets for some time, just to say. All of this brave talk about that project, that's turned to dust. The French and the Germans couldn't agree. There's now apparently going to be a new project, entirely new project, involving the British to build this fighter jet. Anybody who knows anything about procurement issues knows that this is a project of at least 10 to 15 years. And that is being extremely optimistic about schedules. 20 years for a fighter jet of this type is probably closer to reality. And that's on the assumption that this is going to be a well-run program, which it probably won't be, just saying. And, well, there's also been a big problem with building of warships for the German Navy in Dutch shipyards. That project has also turned to dust. So, yes, the Europeans do talk a great deal about war with Russia. It's interesting that they've not really absorbed, they don't actually want to talk about these latest warnings and signals from Moscow. I've not seen a single article in the media here, for example, report the fact that Lavrov has just said that Europe has declared war on Russia. It's nowhere to be found. On the contrary, two of the Baltic states, Estonia and Lithuania, which of course have been the target of warnings from the Russians, warnings from people like Shoigu about and Ulyanov about their treatment of Russian speakers. Anyway, the Baltic governments, the governments of these two Baltic countries, have now criticized Zelensky for warning them that the Russians might indeed have plans to attack them. When actual warnings from Moscow are made, the Baltic governments ignore them. When no such warnings are made, that's when they make them up. I can't help but think that the reality is that European governments, deep down, understand perfectly well that Europe is in no position, whether individually on the part of European states or collectively, to fight the Russians. War talk is fine, whilst there is no real prospect of an actual war, no real danger of it. At that point, you can talk about rearmament and spend vast amounts of money on the subject. You can accuse the Russians of all sorts of things. You can talk about incursions of Russian drones, even whilst you are assisting the Ukrainians, enabling the Ukrainians to conduct their own drone strikes on Russia. But when there is some actual evidence that all of this provocative language, all of these threats, all of these actions are indeed causing the Russian bear to stir, well, then, of course, you don't really want to get into a fight with the bear. So you tell yourself and you tell everybody else, well, actually, it's not for real after all. It's very interesting. And it tells you a great deal about the attitudes and psychology of the European leadership. And, well, there's now been a very interesting article on Unheard, and it, by the way, before that, on Eurointelligence, by Wolfgang Munchau, formerly of the Financial Times, one of the most insightful commentators still left in Europe, though, given the lack of insightful commentators in Europe, perhaps that's being rather kind to him. Though I do actually think Munchau is a good commentator, just saying. Anyway, there's been an interesting article in which he makes some rather sharp, almost waspish points about the recent EU summit meeting in Cyprus, where the European leaders and Zelensky celebrated and cheered each other over the decision to pay over to Ukraine the 90 billion euro loan. Now, I'm not going to discuss that loan further. I've done so in programs on this channel, and Alex and I have recently done a detailed program in which we have forensically discussed this loan, which you can find on the Duran. But there is another aspect to this summit meeting, which is the one that Wolfgang Munchau homes in on, which is that even as they're all toasting and cheering, the Europeans are all toasting and cheering the grant of the loan. At the same time, they're all agreeing with each other and telling the Ukrainians that Ukraine cannot actually join the EU. And I'll quote, the Europeans, this is from Munchau, have a fractious consensus in favour of maintaining support for Ukraine for as long as it takes to reach a war outcome that EU leaders have never defined. Belgium was not ready, however, to incur legal risks for Ukraine. France and Italy were not prepared to provide robust guarantees to Belgium. Hungary, the Czech Republic and Slovakia did not want to take part in the loan. These are the revealed preferences of European politicians, as opposed to their stated preference, in which they pledge unending solidarity for Ukraine. The hypocrisy is most egregious on the topic of Ukraine's EU membership. The EU Commission has discussed the membership light version, which is a nice way of saying no. Ukraine would have neither access to the most important EU policies nor voting rights. Zelensky's smart enough not to fall for these sort of symbolic promises. And then he continues that the EU presents an image of cohesion, yet behind the staged pictures of embraces with Zelensky when he visits the European Council, European tensions are starting to build in the background. The Lithuanian Prime Minister, Inga Ruginiene, this week accused Zelensky of intimidation for his reference to an imminent Russian attack on the Baltic states. The Estonians made the same criticism. I've just discussed that. Zelensky has previously been successful in getting Europeans to believe that Ukraine is fighting the war on Europe's behalf, that the continent's security is at stake. Now that narrative is harder to sustain. Nobody really wants to see Ukraine join Europe. And none other than Friedrich Merz, that most heroic supporter of Ukraine's membership, has just made further statements about how Ukraine's imminent membership of the EU, its membership this year or next year, is clearly impossible. So the Ukrainians have been given their 90 billion euro loan. They've been told that it's going to be enough to last them for 2 years, which it won't be. They're only getting 30 billion of it. The remaining 60 billion is going to be used, if it ever materialises, to fund Europe's own rearmament drive. Just say. So the Ukrainians are going to get 30 billion euros, but it's not enough. Certainly not enough to last them 2 years. To what extent the Europeans understand the realities of the military crisis that Ukraine is actually facing is, of course, unknown to me. But when push comes to shove, they're not really that keen on Ukraine joining the EU. Perhaps, at some level at least, they now are aware that the Russians are no longer supportive, are becoming increasingly hostile to this idea also. Notice that in that speech of Lavrov's, which I discussed earlier in the programme, the one he made yesterday to the non-profit agencies, the one in which he said that Europe has declared war on Russia. He said that the EU and NATO are increasingly becoming one, and how he referred to the international bureaucracy in Brussels as being Russia's main adversary. I've already said that Medvedev has spoken about how Russia should take back its agreement that Ukraine join the EU. It seems that, well, Lavrov has also spoken in the same way. Other Russian officials have increasingly taken to doing so. And, well, just yesterday, we see Lavrov talk about the international bureaucracy in Brussels and about how the EU and NATO have in effect become one. So the Russians, of this I am now sure, at some point over the next few months are going to confirm publicly. Putin is going to confirm publicly that Russia's agreement to Ukraine's EU membership has been withdrawn, that the Russians have changed from their previous stance of actually supporting that idea to straightforwardly opposing it. What should really be happening in this situation, given the military realities on the Ukrainian battlefronts, given this rhetoric that is now building up in Moscow, this talk of war between Russia and Europe, given that the support of the United States is now in doubt, as it has never been before at any time since the end of the Second World War, given that the Prime Minister of Poland, Donald Tusk, is now actually coming out and saying that Europe can no longer rely on the United States, which can no longer be considered an ally, and given the actual military realities in Ukraine itself, and the fact that the Europeans themselves appear to be cooling on the whole idea of Ukraine's EU membership. Given all this, obviously, the moment to reach out to the Russians, to put aside all of the cliches and memes and demands, to discuss with the Russians European security, the future of Ukraine, and critically, a resumption of Russian energy supplies to Europe. Clearly, we're not just at that moment. We are at the moment when doing all of these things is becoming a desperate, imperative priority. One would have thought that the European leaders, instead of meeting and congratulating each other upon the fact that they've given 30 billion euros to Zelensky to disappear quickly in bank accounts in all the usual places. Instead of celebrating that, they ought to be urgently conferring with each other about how they're going to deal with the worst economic and security crisis that Europe has faced since the end of the Second World War. Are they doing that? Of course not. Not a single major European leader, especially now that Orban is on his way out, is proposing or talking about doing any such thing. I'm going to make a prediction. By the autumn, it is going to be impossible to go on pretending that the situation in the war in Ukraine is going well. On the contrary, defeat in Ukraine is going to become increasingly impossible to deny. We're going to be in a deep economic crisis because of the war with Iran, which, by the way, I fully expect to be still ongoing in the autumn. And I'm going to further guess that relations between the United States and Europe by that point will have deteriorated even further. We are going to be in a very bad position by September, October, indeed, with winter almost upon us. So what do the European leaders do? They meet in Cyprus, toast and celebrate each other because they've given Zelensky another 90 or is it 30 billion euros? I've said it many times, if there's ever been a time when the quality of political leadership in Europe has been lower, then I cannot remember when that was. Well, this is where I'm going to finish my programme today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.